Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I am your host, Dominic Enyart, and I was recently talking with my brother, Zachary, and he was telling me about this YouTuber. The guy is an open theist, and he was criticizing Calvinists at the time. And, you know, me and my brother, we go to a church that's largely Calvinist, not Denver Bible Church, but we're driving up in the mountains here in Colorado, and we're talking about an argument that this guy makes, this YouTuber, and he was saying that Calvinists will tend to say is God is the ultimate, maximum, hyper good. He's the essence of goodness, and therefore that must mean that God has every good attribute. Now, I think that knowing the future is a good attribute, therefore he must know the future, and you know what, even further, he must know the future exhaustively. And that's kind of like saying God is the, you know, ultimate, maximum, hyper essence of good. And that must mean that God has every good attribute. Well, you know what? I think hats are cool. I think hats are pretty great. And therefore, God must wear a hat. And even more so, God must wear infinite hats, because if one hat is good, you know, two hats is better. Infinite is the best. God must wear infinite hats, which, of course, is absurd. And this is exactly what Calvinists do. But so my brother's telling me about this open theist guy on YouTube. Well, anyways, I started watching this guy's YouTube channel, and it turns out it's the one and only Chris Fisher. And he's been a lifelong friend of our ministry and a champion of open theism for years. I just never knew that he had a YouTube channel. Anyways, this guy is really brilliant. He's the host of Reality is Not Optional on YouTube. He's the author of God is Open. He's the creator of a Facebook group for open theists called God is Open, which I had been a part of for years, and it's a tremendously valuable resource for open theists. I recommend you check it out. But so, Chris, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. You've got a debate coming up. Tell us about that.
Well, thanks for having me on the program. This is actually pretty exciting. I think this might be like a first live radio type show. I've been on YouTube for years, but never on the airwaves. So that is exciting. So a debate coming up. I need to pull up the picture that I have of it to remind me of the title, because sometimes these things are easy to forget. It's, does the Bible teach that God knows the future exhaustively? And that wording, it wasn't picked by me. It was picked by Will Duffy, who's been engaged in a few of these debates in the past. And he's very meticulous in choosing the context of the debate topic so that there's like no wasted words.
Which Will Duffy is your debate partner, which is, you know, to me, that's exciting. I know all of our listeners know the name Will Duffy, and he's been in dozens of debates. The most popular by far is his debate with Matt Slick, and he is an incredible debater. So I'm very excited about the two of you going head to head with these two Calvinists, Dane and Dan, yeah. I think their names are.
That was a fun experience. I was there live at the Matt Slick debate, and I got all sorts of stories from that, but maybe for another time.
Sure.
But yeah, you said they're not Calvinists. They're a normal Arminian or non-Calvinist. Our debate opponents is Dan Chapa and Dane Van Ice. And so they seem like good people. I think I was watching one of Dan Chapa's videos, and he seemed to be knowledgeable. He seemed to be a thinker, someone who considers arguments and puts together coherent thoughts. And that's what you actually want in debate critics, is a thinking individual, someone you could actually interact with, who wants to treat the things you're saying with honesty. So it does appear from everything that I've gained so far that that's going to be this type of debate.
Gotcha. And I appreciate the clarification that they're Arminians, not Calvinists. I tend to lump all, we call them on Bob and Yurt Live, the settled viewers. And I tend to lump all of them into one group of settled viewers. So I appreciate that you hold me to a higher standard there. But like you were saying with the debate title, I love it so much because it's super specific. A debate tip to all you open theists listening, be as specific as possible. Settled viewers love to be slippery and try and get out of stuff. So when you're very specific, it helps to, you know, it's like nailing Jell-O to a wall. It's hard, but if you can be specific, it helps. But so the topic is, does the Bible teach that God knows the future exhaustively? And this is so much better than just, does God know the future exhaustively? Especially because there isn't a single verse that indicates that he does. Even if it indicates God knows something about the future, it says nothing about his exhaustive knowledge. So even when they twist the scriptures around, it still won't work for them. And I believe this will be a slam dunk for open theism.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, like, I know the future. Yesterday, I was talking to a bunch of Calvinists. I said, "Oh, I'm going to go to bed tonight. I know that." And they're like, "You don't know that." It's like, "Yeah, well, I do know that. It's going to happen." And no one on this planet, except for like Calvinists, that's who I was talking to yesterday, would claim that I don't have knowledge of the future when I say I'm going to go to bed tonight and then wake up tomorrow morning. And both those things did, in fact, happen. It's not like I'm omniscient or anything.
So you have exhaustive knowledge of the future.
Yeah, me showing that I had that one piece of knowledge doesn't prove that I knew everything. And this is not like uncommon. So when you have Abraham and Sarah, and Abraham wants to go to Egypt, and he says, "Hey, Sarah, I know you're a beautiful woman. And I know that when I go there, they're going to kill me and they're going to take you as their wife. So how about this? We just pretend you're my sister." So he had knowledge of the future and future contingents. And he used his knowledge of the future to subvert what was going to happen in the future. This is the normal understanding of what knowledge is. And so, yeah, open theists should not be claiming that God doesn't know the future. Yeah, God knows the future. God knows things that are going to happen in the future. But the question is, what type of knowledge does he have of the future? Is it this settled knowledge where he has direct access to propositional truths? Is it this type of knowledge that they actually claim? And so if I were to actually have decided the name of this debate or the topic, it would be, does the Bible teach classical omniscience? Because that actually pigeonholes them even further, because classical omniscience denies a lot of things that we would normally ascribe to knowledge. Like, knowledge is discursive. You think about things. When we pray to God, he considers our prayers and figures out answers and how to respond to us and considers our petitions, whether to fulfill them or not. There's an entire bargaining that happens between Abraham and God before he goes and visits Sodom about the number of righteous that he's going to accept for salvation of Sodom. And so this discursive type of knowledge where you're thinking about things is actually prohibited in classical omniscience. God can't have this type of omniscience because his knowledge would then be changing. His knowledge set would not be static. In order for God to have this classical omniscience, and this is basically what the current debate title is about, if God knows the future exhaustively, he's not going to have this type of discursive thinking type knowledge. God thinks within the Bible, God thinks, therefore open theism is true. Does that make sense?
Amen. Yeah, no, that was perfect. And we're going to get into it in a little bit here. What is God's character and some attributes about God? And one of the attributes that I had is that he's interactive. And like with Moses, he pleads, you know, don't destroy all Israel. You promised, you know, our forefathers that you would be faithful. And he petitions God and God interacts with him. And that sways God and it touched his heart. And so that's something that with a fully settled view, it's either, you know, God was lying or that he is touched by human interaction. And it does seem, you know, clear to me, at least, maybe not to the settled viewers, but that God interacts with us and that means that he can't have exhaustive knowledge of the future.
All right. So listen to a couple of our this debate's interesting. They asked each side to come up with three subtopics. And our first one is, what does the Bible tell us as to how God obtains information? And so it's not like we have to sit around. I was actually watching one of my debate opponents, the upcoming ones. He's on this podcast and it's, how does God obtain his knowledge? And they're sitting around and they're thinking about it. They're like, well, we don't quite know, but it's kind of this direct access. It's like, well, if we read the Bible, it's not like a guessing game. It's not like we have to sit there and theorize, oh, what is the way that God becomes acquainted with the knowledge? It's described throughout the Bible. God tests to know. Just if you go to your Bible and pull up the search, test to know. Deuteronomy 8:2, he tests to know. If you if you look at the Psalms, God watches to know.
I think
God
of Abraham of when he tests Abraham and he says, "Now I know." So
yeah, absolutely. And so God tests to know. God watches to know. God knows because God does. And that's the whole point of Isaiah 40 through 48. I tell you what I'm going to do before I do it. Therefore, you know it's me when I do it. that's the type of knowledge he's describing. He knows because he plans out and has the power to accomplish. God knows because he interacts with us, right? He's got an experiential knowledge of people. That's actually how foreknowledge is used within the New Testament. It's not this type of propositional knowledge. Oh, I know Bob Enyart's name. Well, no, that's not what it's talking about. It's about a personal interaction, a personal knowledge. Paul says that the Jews foreknew him, the same word used for God. And what he means is they have had a prior relationship together.
Which so, that to me makes the Bible seem, you know, and God's character seem so much more alive and real. When I'm going through something difficult, I can go to God and I can turn to him and I can interact with him and he can help me. And it's not just something that was foreordained, that God knew it would be exactly like this. And, you know, I would go through these hardships and he would help me in this way. That to me seems like that would be such a fake and uncomfortable relationship. It would be mainly meaningless. But when there's this interaction and this relationship, it just, to me, it seems so much more personal and meaningful and beautiful than the, you know, settled view version of things.
Have you ever heard these closed theists and their constant claim? I've started copying it when I see it so I could have a database of all these claims. They say prayer doesn't change God. Prayer changes us. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard that?
Yes, many times.
Oh, it's the Bible just screams against it. Every time the Bible talks about prayer, it's about, for example, Jesus's parable of if you nag this judge hard enough, he's going to respond to you. How much more will God respond to you?
Wow.
And every single example of prayer in the Bible is Ezekiel. He tells Ezekiel, he's like, do all these signs for Israel. And he's like, sleep on your left side for all these days, sleep on your right side for all these days. Also, you need to start cooking your food with human waste. And Ezekiel's like, that's not kosher, Lord, please. And he says, okay, fine. We'll do cow dung. In the course of like a minute, God changes his mind in response to a petition from his people. And so prayers, they avail much. God listens and responds to prayers.
One of my favorite examples of that is, I believe it's Peter who says, we can pray to hasten the coming of the Lord. And so he's saying we can pray to change a future event, which I think illustrates it perfectly.
Yeah, we will be actually talking tonight about King David. And King David, if you read his prayers, they are all petitionary. Almost every single one. I've had my kids grab random psalms and do a Bible study, have each of my kids host a Bible study. And inevitably, they'll grab a psalm by King David because there's so many of them. And inevitably, the pattern is going to be the same. David is in a time of need. He says, God, where are you? Listen to me. Hear my prayers. God, if you save me, I can praise you. And you value praise, so that's a good thing to save me. If I die, you don't get my praise anymore. So he's actually giving practical arguments to God why God should save him. And then the psalm ends with God fulfilling or hopes of God fulfilling those promises or those prayers. So King David, his entire relationship with God is this type of relationship where he believes God listens, God responds. God's not just a set and static out there. Our interaction with God can change God. And one thing, another way that I haven't listed so far that God, how God becomes acquainted with his knowledge is God predicts. And so Psalms 139, probably the most famous psalm, maybe Psalm 22 might be the most famous, but I hear 139 referenced all the time, and especially closed view individuals saying that the future is all set. They quote 139 as if that's what's being claimed there. But if you actually read Psalms 139, David starts out, he says, a psalm of David, oh Lord, you have searched and known me. So mm-hmm. How does God know King David?
By searching.
Because he searched him and he's known me. And then in verse 4 says, even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. Why? Because God has searched him and known him. And so he can predict what King David is going to say. God can predict things in the future due to his personal relationships with people. And King David ends that psalm. He says, keep searching me, Lord. See if there's any wicked way in me. Because King David is an open theist. He's not a closed theist. He doesn't have this view of God that, oh, prayer changes us and not God. That's not his view.
Which your debate partner, Will Duffy, he has his website, opentheism.org. And what I love about that website is his verse list, which is opentheism.org/verses. And he's divided it into 33 different categories. And category number 23 on his verse list is God's people believe God can change his mind. And there's, you know, a dozen verses in there about that, which I love so much because it's not just us saying, okay, we look at the Bible, here's our conclusions. It's what did the people in the Bible, what were their conclusions about God? And overwhelmingly, their conclusions were, they were in open view. They all believed that God could change his mind.
Yeah, absolutely. One of our subtopics, I know I just listed off one of our three, but the third one is Exodus 32. It's just a statement. It's not even a question. Exodus 32 is one of many examples in the scripture that describe God changing his mind due to outside input. Why? Because Moses, when he's on Mount Sinai, he's trying to convince God, number one, not to destroy Israel. And that's his biggest thing. God's angry about to destroy Israel. God says, hey, I'm going to just kill all of Israel and make a new Israel through you. I'll still be fulfilling my promises to Abraham, but now through your lineage as well. And he gives them a cascading list of reasons why not to. Why? Why does he do that? Because he believes that he can use persuasive arguments to affect the heart of God and change God's mind. And within that passage, God repents of what he said he was going to do. He did not destroy all of Israel.
Right. And I have a point that I want to get to in a little bit more in depth a little bit later on in the show. But one thing about when I'm talking to Calvinists, I might say something like, you know, well, the way you present God makes him seem immoral. To me, the way you present him, what you just described, your model of God is immoral. And the way they tend to respond to that is they say, well, who are you and who are we? We're just humans to say that God is immoral. That's their response. And that has always kind of irked me a little bit because when we
Well, I'm Chris, and so
right, yeah, I'm Chris. I'm Dominic.
That's the trite answer.
Yes, but like in the Bible, when people go to God and they criticize him, God doesn't just say, "Who are you to criticize me?" He takes their criticisms and deals with them. Earlier, you had mentioned Abraham and Sarah. I believe it was Abimelech who he wanted to marry Sarah, and so he was pursuing her. And then God got really mad at Abimelech and said, you're a dead man for pursuing this woman. And he said, I didn't realize it was Abraham's wife. I didn't know that. Would you kill me? Would you destroy a righteous nation also? And God, instead of saying, who are you, oh man, to criticize me? He said, you know what? That's a good point. I'm not going to kill you, but if you pursue her, I will kill you. And so we see this interaction that God has with humanity, that it's not just, he doesn't just talk down to us as if we're, you know, morons. He interacts with us as if we have valuable things to say.
Yeah, God accepts inputs from creatures. And you see that in 1 Kings 22, in which God is sitting in the divine assembly and says, hey, guys, how do we kill this Ahab guy? And all the angels are they're prompted to all come up with plans, and then he decides between them what's the best plan, because he cares about our input. He actually considers it. We're not like these worms that are so far below him that he just pays us no mind ever. That is not the thought. We are actually made in the image of God, which gives us inherent value.
Which no theology makes less of that concept than Calvinism. Calvinism is, they have this weird obsession with self-hatred where they constantly talk about how evil and immoral and sinful and broken they are. And, you know, I definitely appreciate the sentiment that we need Jesus to redeem us and forgive us and that we're hopeless without him. But they tend to just forget that we are made in his image and that we have value. And I feel like that's just a inherent negative consequence of Calvinism, is this self-hatred. But so you had mentioned you have three subtopics. I know we got number one, how does God obtain knowledge? Number three, Exodus 32 is one of many examples of God changing his mind due to outside input. What was the second subtopic of the debate?
The second one is going to be fantastic. According to the Bible, has God ever had the ability to change what would happen? Can God change the future? Can something be in the future that God knows and God change that? Does God have that ability?
And of course, he does.
Famous example. Well, I guess I'll just give a ton of examples for every single subpoint. So if my debate critics or if my debate opponents are actually listening here, they might get a preview of the debate. Jesus said, he's in the garden, and he said, I could call upon 12 legions of angels, and God would save me from this event, from being captured, from being crucified. And then in the garden, he's praying, and he says, not my will, but yours be done. Why? Because in Jesus's mind, the crucifixion was not a set event. It could change. All Jesus had to do was pray for it, and God could change the plans, God's plans. And since the world began, he's had this plan for communion with man, and probably through Jesus in some sort of crucifixion type event, God would change that due to outside input or prompting. And Jesus had to ward against that with his prayer, not my will, but yours be done.
Which I made that exact point to some Calvinist friends of mine with my brother Zachary. We were in a little debate. My brother is a large fan of yours. He was the one who got me hooked on your YouTube channel.
Oh.
But we were in a debate with these Calvinists, an informal debate, you know, just in their living room. And I made that exact point that the cross wasn't this eternally predestined event that was 100% going to occur, that it had to occur. And you would think that based off of their reaction that I just said that God was, you know, a rapist or something, like they really, really resisted that very harshly and heavily. And it's just surprising how wildly different our theologies are.
So let me tell you why. It's because that's one of their big talking points against open theism. Like, oh, if open theism is true, then the cross might not have had to happen. If open theism is true, then God might not know anyone ever is saved. And so if that's actually one of your talking points, not saying, oh, I believe the cross wasn't fated, but saying Jesus believed it. Now they're not fighting you. They're fighting Jesus. And they don't know what to do with that because that's their ingrained talking point to try to criticize you, a view that Jesus actually held. It's funny. It's funny to watch their reactions to this.
Yes. And it seems that they are all so unfamiliar with open theism. And so it cracks me up here talking with them. But so the main topic of today's show is, what is God's character? We had both come up with some attributes. I was hoping maybe we could start going through those. I know my dad has produced a resource, What Are the 5 Biblical Attributes of God? And he is living, personal, relational, good, and loving. And that's a sermon series he did. I recommend that you guys check that out. But we have a few other examples, and we're not going to be going through those 5. You had taken some examples of qualities that David had, who David was a man after God's own heart, and that he had had. What were some of the attributes that you had come up with that God had shared with David?
This is actually pretty interesting. There's one individual in the Bible who's described as a man after God's own heart. And so the classical conception of God is that he's immutable and he's outside of space and time and all these ideas. He can't change in any way whatsoever. But guess what? There's men after God's own heart. God has a heart. God has a personality. God has a character. Within the Bible, God has personality. God is a person. And so if anyone's a Trinitarian, they should automatically agree, 3 persons, God is a person.
And one of my favorite points, sorry to interrupt, but one of my favorite things that my dad, Bob Enyart, liked to do is he liked to get the Myers-Briggs personality test. I know a lot of people dislike that, but our family loves it. And he liked to ascribe personality aspects to Jesus in the Bible to kind of help illustrate how much of a person he was. And one example is that Jesus was an introvert. He was a person, and he often liked to go off and be alone. And so he had personality traits. It's not like he's just this block of this is what God is, and that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a reason that David is the star of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. It's because of who he is, his character. People read about him and he's compelling. He's not perfect. He's not like a Gary Sue is the term for writing when you just make someone super perfect without any flaws and no room for to grow. He has a character arc within the Bible, but you get used to him, you're reading him, and everything that strikes you about him are very admirable type of characteristics. For example, number one, he's attractive. Saul's described, and Saul's kind of attractive, and Saul's really tall. David, his height's not really discussed at all, but his attractiveness is, which is interesting. And of course, God is beautiful. He's made this beautiful world for us. There's so much beauty all around us that one of your dad's arguments, I guess, to this, the atheist in his atheist debate was the beauty proves God's existence. You can know God's character from his creation. And so attractiveness is number one. Being bold, King David fights lions and bears. He's a kid, and he goes after these. I don't know if you've ever seen a bear. These things are huge. Terrifying. These lions are huge.
Yeah, I was up in Yellowstone, and I was with my brother Michael, and I have a video of it on my phone of a cub. And it was about maybe 80 feet away from us. And I was filming it, I guess, because I was an idiot at the time and I wasn't running for my life. That's probably what I should have been doing.
Was it a black or a brown bear?
I believe it was a brown bear, if memory serves. This was maybe six years ago. But I'm filming it and it starts running towards us. And I just thought, well, I'm going to die. That's it. You know, goodbye world. And it jumps up in this tree, and it was the most terrifying experience of my life. It jumped up into a tree. It probably closed the distance like 80 feet to maybe 15 feet away from us, just perched in a tree looking at us in maybe about 3 seconds. And that was one of the most terrifying things that I've ever done.
Fighting wild animals is no joke. These modern people who, if I don't know if you've ever seen those polls where it's like, can you beat an elephant in the fight? And a lot of like, there's like 10 or 20% of guys who say, yeah, I could beat an elephant. It's like, what are you doing? That's not going to work at all.
Yeah, good
and
luck.
So King David is bold. He'll go out and he'll fight. God is a bold God. Just think about God's challenges to other deities. And Isaiah, he says, do anything, try it. Try it. I'm better than you.
Right. Bold. Oh, you're just a rock. Yeah.
Yeah. Unapologetic. Now, David is unapologetic. Let's say his interaction was with Goliath. It's very telling. Go read how David handles the Goliath incident, and you're going to get a lot of characteristics of King David that are coming out. He's number one, he's sickened by this Philistine coming out and blaspheming God. His sense of morality, he has a strong sense of rightness and justice, and that's being violated by this Philistine, this pagan who's blaspheming God, and it makes him internally angry. So angry, in fact, that he's a little kid, and he's going to challenge a giant to a fight. So he's unapologetic.
Which takes a lot of boldness. And now, unapologetic, yes, that is not to be confused with unrepentant, because that seems to be one of David's greatest qualities, in my mind, is that he always was repentant. He did a lot of bad stuff, but he always would go back and repent and say, I'm so, so sorry. Please forgive me. Make me white as snow. I know Psalm 51, he wrote after Nathan confronted him about Bathsheba. And that has served my life well reading that, because I know in my own personal life, sometimes after I've sinned, it's hard to come back to God. And when I'm in that place, I go to Psalm 51 and I just see the humility that David had and the repentance that he had. And I try and emulate that in my own personal life. So unapologetic doesn't mean unrepentant. He was extremely repentant, one of his best qualities.
Yeah, he goes into the camp of his friends, as he's seen this Goliath blaspheme God, says, what are you guys doing? Why aren't you doing anything about this? You guys all scared? And they're like, oh, you're just a little kid. You just came to watch the battle. You're just talk. You're all talk and no action. And he's like, no, I'm going to kill this giant. I'm going to go do it. And he goes and demands. He's confident. So confident is another attribute, a strong attribute of King David. He's confident. So no, I'm going to go kill this guy and God's going to help me. And his faith and trust in God, his loyalty, you might say, his loyalty to God, his faith in God, his trust in God was immense. You see it throughout the Psalms. You go read the King David Psalms, and he's dying in Psalms 22. His bones are sticking out because he's actually starving. People are surrounding him, trying to kill him, and he still has faith in God. And it's strong and intense, and it reads out in the Psalms. Every single Psalm that he writes pours out with this intense loyalty, this intense faith to God,
which we can also draw from that and have confidence in our own lives because we have a relationship with Christ, I always find myself thinking, you know, through the worst case and best case scenarios of what could happen. Best case scenario, I make this bet and I win $5, something like that. It's best case scenario. Worst case scenario, you know, I get kidnapped by Muslims and I get tortured until I die. And so that's pretty bad. But I can have confidence in the Lord that he will have victory over sin and death in the end, and that I should just do right and risk the consequences, and I can move forward with confidence in my own life, even knowing that the world can hurt me. But since I have this relationship with Christ, I know when the world stands against me, if I'm with Christ, I will have victory in the end. So when you have this personal relationship with God, like how David did especially, it's no surprise that he would be so confident.
Yeah, David said, 1 Samuel 17:37, "Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you." Saul's kind of weak. Wow. Why is it Saul? Saul's the tallest guy in all of Israel. He's not out there fighting a giant. He's sending a little kid to go fight the giant instead of him. This is the difference between these two people, why God is picking David over Saul, partly because of Saul. Saul's King David kind of gets this way in his later years, where he sends other people to go do his fighting. He becomes less bold because, of course, David has a character arc. He starts off very strong, and then there is this gradual decay. There's a gradual pulling away and a gradual decline of his character that you read about. You see that character arc within the life of Samuel. So just looking at my list of attributes of what I see in King David throughout his reign, and so throughout Samuel 1 and 2, how about this? He has this strong sense of what is right. There's an instance where King David is running from King Saul, and his loyalty to King Saul is without question. He had multiple opportunities to kill King Saul, to assume the kingdom for himself, but his sense of justice, his sense of rightness is absolute loyalty, even though God's anointed him as king, absolute loyalty to the first king of Israel, so much so that when someone says that they killed Saul because Saul ordered them to kill him, Saul committed self-suicide and then wasn't able to complete it, and so another individual came along and completed the suicide for him. When that is reported to David, David has that man killed, has that man ripped apart, because it was such a violation of God in order to kill God's anointed. So King David himself isn't going to do that. So when he's on the run, there is an instance where he helps sheep herders from another house, another individual, and he expects some sort of hospitality in return. He sends his servants to Nabal's house, and they ask for hospitality. And Nabal, he treats them rudely. He basically says, you're nobody. We're not doing anything for you. Go do whatever. Oh, we don't care. And so this violates David's sense of integrity, his hospitality. And what he tells his men, he says, everyone, go put on your arms. Let's grab our swords, and we're going to go kill this guy. And then Abigail, Nabal's wife, she figures out all this is happening, and she's like, I would rather not be dead than dead. And so she goes about and behind Nabal's back tries to arrange this truce. But just notice how King David acts. His sense of integrity and justice is violated, and he's going out to right the wrong, avenge that wrong.
Yeah, and we have an ongoing joke in my family that Saul is really bad at throwing spears, because I believe it's either two or three times Saul tries to throw a spear at David and he misses and David gets out. And then it's been clear that Saul wants David dead. And then, like you were saying, that story when someone comes off and finishes the suicide, that David has that person killed. Then after that, then David, there's a whole chapter of David just weeping in sorrow that this guy who was trying to kill him is now dead because he was the Lord's anointed. And I can imagine if someone's trying to kill me and then they die, I feel like I would be celebrating. I'd be happy that they're dead. But here we see David and his strong sense of integrity. It's not just that he's not fighting back against Saul and trying to kill Saul because he's supposed to. He genuinely has a love of integrity and a love of the Lord's anointed.
Yeah, it's a strong sense of violations of right and wrong and principle. One thing, I'm going to skip forward a little bit. to talk about how he ignores the people based on principle. There's a time in his ruling in which he has to go avenge his city. His city's raided by these raiders, and he catches up with them, but he has to leave people behind to guard the carts while his main fighting force goes forth and kills the enemy, reclaims his wife, reclaims all the children, all these things. And the people who went out fighting said, "We should not give any money or spoils or anything to these people who stayed and watched the carts." But to King David, that was a terrible idea. He thought that was unfair, that you still need to incentivize and reward people for doing a critical thing such as guarding your supply wagons. And so he put out a decree. He said, no, everyone gets equal rewards. If you go out and fight, you get the same rewards as the people who stay back with the carts, because he cared about that sense of fairness and integrity. And the people who went out to fight, they're all mad at him, but he's in defiance of them, standing up for what he believes is the correct principle.
Which is so easy to, you know, just bend to the crowd and bend, you know, it makes me think about cancel culture, how, you know, a billion people will start tweeting about you and people just tend to, you know, back down and they fold and they say, you know, I'm sorry, you're right, just don't kill me or whatever. But it really goes to show, and that's just over Twitter, and almost never do people say, like, stand up to the mob and say, no, you're wrong. So you can imagine with King David, he's standing up to actual people who are actually there in his face saying, no, you're wrong. And that takes, you know, that boldness, and it's that unapologeticness that you mentioned earlier to, you know, say what you think is right and to stand up for that, even though the masses disagree with you.
Yeah, think about that in contrast to Saul. And Saul, when he's deposed in 1 Samuel 15, God repents of making him king. That means he decided that making Saul king was a bad decision, and he undoes that decision. And Saul, he's trying to defend his actions. He didn't do what God had commanded him to do and kill all the sheep and all the livestock and all the people of the Amalekites. And guess what? He gives as an excuse, he says, the people, I did it for the people. That's what they were asking for. We're going to go back and sacrifice these to you. He listened to the people. So listening to the people was not a strong, it wasn't a selling point for the Saul kingship.
Right. Just a quick aside about that, God, he regretted that he made Saul king. A lot of Calvinists love to say, oh, that's just a figure of speech. And, you know, if you ask them what the figure of speech means, they have no idea. But it's funny, they say it's a figure of speech, but a point that my dad loved to make is he said that, and then he actually went through with it and then took Saul down, and he was no longer the king. And it's funny because a figure of speech cannot be an action. You know, I can punch you in the face, and that is an action. That's not a figure of speech. I can't later on say, oh, you know, sorry that I punched you in the face. I didn't actually do it. That was just a figure of speech. It was an actual action that God took Saul, took the kingship away from Saul.
Yeah, it's integral to the plot of the story. So it explains character motivation. It explains plot development. It explains why things happen in this order that they do happen. So if you're trying to say that that's not like historical, or that's just idiomatic, and that really just destroys the story which is being told. The story does not make sense anymore. You're taking away crucial elements that play into the narrative as it unfolds. And so you don't want to just make everything idiomatic because it doesn't agree with your theology at the expense of what the actual context is, what's happening in context. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah. And now the next thing you had on the list of attributes that David shares with God is that he's impulsive, which you had mentioned earlier about how David went to fight the giant. It's an impulsive thing that he doesn't think too long or too hard. He just thinks, you know, this is right. I'm going to go do this.
Yeah, absolutely. One funny example of impulsiveness is Saul tried to kill David right after David killed Goliath. I don't know if you remember this. But he's like, oh, I promised you my daughter. What's a good way to get you killed? Oh, go collect body parts off of dead Philistines that you kill somewhere. They have to be fresh dead people. So you can't use the already dead ones. So you got to go collect all these body parts. And King David, he's like, okay, I'll go do it. And he goes and does it. And does not get killed off. and Saul's plans are foiled. But remember, we were just talking about Exodus 32. God is watching Israel in the desert. They're all rebelling against him. They're building golden calves. They're just rejecting him. He had just rescued them out of Egypt. And he says, I'm just going to kill them all. Is that impulsive? That sounds impulsive.
That seems impulsive to me. Yeah.
And so who has to intervene? It's someone who has more of I don't know if it's more of he has some sort of emotional attachment to the people or some sort of plan for the people. Moses intervenes and he says, hey, God, don't kill these people, because here's the following reasons. Number one, they're your people. So killing your own people is like not very good. He says, what about your promises to Abraham? Ever think about that? I know you can fulfill it through me and all, but really, that's not the intent of your original promise. And then he says, hey, what are these Egyptians going to think about you? They're going to say, hey, this is just a death cult God. He came to save them. He led them into the wilderness, and then he just killed them all. What's going on here? This Yahweh is like the worst God ever.
So Moses is actually encouraging God to be less impulsive and say, no, just, you know, think about it a little bit longer. Don't do this.
He's tempering God's impulsiveness, which you also see in the Sodom and Gomorrah negotiation. At what point is it good to destroy the wicked with the righteous? That entire back and forth, whittling down those numbers. But in this case, that argument actually swayed God. And so if you read elsewhere in the Bible when it's recounting this, because this is actually really famous in the Bible, you have all sorts of times in the Bible that look back and recount this incident. In Ezekiel, he says, I did not act. In the Exodus 32 incident, God says, I did not act except for my own name's sake. What does that mean? He wanted to preserve the integrity of what it meant to be Yahweh in the eyes of those pagan people. And throughout the Bible, sometimes God acts for his own name's sake. Sometimes God forgets sins for his own sake. Sometimes God does the stuff for himself, for his perception, people's perception of God, outside of God, because he actually cares about what people think. He actually cares about what the pagan nations, how they characterize him.
Well, he wants us to worship him. You know, he wants us to worship him. That's the meaning of life, is to worship and glorify God. And so that's, in my opinion, I feel like that's why God created us, is to worship him. So obviously he cares about what we think of him, and he wants us to worship him, and he wants us to think well of him.
You do find those trade-offs that God goes through, and he thinks through these issues. He's got this impulsive character. God has a strong sense of righteousness and justice, but you have to weigh those considerations against other considerations, such as public perception. What does my creation think about me? Let's look at this list of attributes of King David. How about his intensity? You ever read the Psalms? Do you ever sit down and read the Psalms and ask yourself, who's talking? What situation are they in? Who are they talking to? And what are they communicating? Do you ever do that little exercise?
Yeah, I was actually just reading Psalm 2 the other day, and I thought it was funny that David was talking about the kings of the world and how God, he mocks them and he holds them in derision, and that he like laughs at them. I thought that was so different from how the church today loves to portray, you know, the Bible. The church loves to portray it as this soft, kind, feminine gospel. Whereas when you sit down and look at it, you see God's people, and David is a good example of this, talking about, you know, mocking the enemies of God. And he is very intense.
Yeah. So I would kind of liken it to a lot of modern Christians want to make God into, let's say you're watching Star Trek and they got this Spock guy, and the Spock guy is cold, cool, collected, and just pure logic and pure reason, just thinking about things stoically. But in the Bible, you don't get that picture of God. You get a Captain Kirk picture where God goes out and does things and has intense pleasure, has intense pain, is mentally tormented by his creation. God says that he's weary of repenting at some places. He's like, you guys have caused me so much mental grief. This is what you get. God's intensity, though, God is intense. He floods the world. That's incredibly intense. God's intense emotions that you get throughout the Bible. God sings over us. God weeps over us. Intensity.
And you can imagine the cross. That's one of the most intense things, is the Father pouring out his wrath on the Son. I can't fathom of something more intense than that.
Yeah, so it's a very stark picture from the classical view of God, in which God is cold, impassionate. He's impassible. So impassible is a classical attribute that says that God cannot feel emotions. And this is co-needed. This is codependent on other attributes that are classical attributes, such as immutability and pure simplicity. All these attributes will deny this intensity to God, deny God the ability to feel emotion and pleasure. So talking about that, King David is incredibly passionate. So he dances naked in the streets for God, and his wife is just
His wife asks him to stop. And I remember that when he was dancing, it was kind of like the Michael Scott saying to Pam, "Oh, I'm going to start dating your mom even harder now." David kind of did the same thing. He said, "Oh, you want me to stop dancing in the streets? I'm going to start dancing in the streets even harder now." And he's so intense and vibrant about it. And I pray that I can have that same intensity, especially with my worship to God.
That would be a very interesting church service. I would suggest clothing, though. Is my one modification is probably don't dance naked.
I will take your advice on that one.
But imagine that God creates people, and one of his reasons is God's own curiosity. And you see God, his first act is bringing the animals to Adam to see what Adam's going to call them. God's curiosity in human beings is incredibly important. So then you have a character, King David, who will literally dance in a near ecstasy for you because he's so in love with you. He worships you. That's what you desire. A lot of these Psalms of King David are centered around that. If I die, you're not going to get my praise anymore. So you got some sort of vested interest, God, in keeping me alive, because you do, in fact, enjoy and get benefit from my praise. There is a relationship there. This relationship doesn't carry to the grave.
Yes. So, and it's almost like a trade interaction that we get, you know, eternal salvation, and God gets our worship and praise. And that is something that God wants, and he desires it, which that goes against the impassibility that God can't have emotion and can't feel. He does want and desire our praise, and that makes him happy.
Yeah, not only that, but one of the classical attributes is this self-sufficiency. And what they mean by that, it's not like your son's self-sufficient, so he goes out and gets a job and has his own house. That's not what they mean by self-sufficiency. They mean God cannot benefit or gain anything from outside himself. That's what they actually mean, because that would cause dependencies in the Godhead. And just like you opened up this entire talk with, that violates their idea of perfection, because, oh, if you could gain from outside sources, that means you're not perfect. Therefore, God can't enjoy interacting with his people.
Right, which the Bible never says anything like that. That's fully their own box that they put on God, that God has to fit in this, that he can't take anything in to himself. It's only self-sufficient. The Bible never says that. That's only their qualification that they give to God.
Yeah, absolutely. How about this? I was watching a podcast where there's an individual, we'll call him Mr. Rogers, Anthony Rogers. Anthony Rogers had a podcast where he's talking about open theism, and Warren McGrew, he's in the chat, and he says, God is brilliant. And the guy, a Calvinist, he laughs. He's like, brilliant's not a word that I think of when I think about God.
It's like, okay, you think God is not brilliant. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly true. Because why? Because in their system, they have no use for God being brilliant. They have no use for God being clever. They have no use for God thinking and doing and being practical. How about this? King David is clever. So he figures out situations. He looks at situations and says, hey, this Saul guy, I think he wants to kill me just a little bit. And so we'll devise all this entire test to see if he's still trying to kill me or if he's actually softened to me. And so he enlists Jonathan, Saul's son, in this affair. And Jonathan talks to his dad and tries to figure out if the dad is angry at David's absence. And it turns out he is. So David is actually able to innovate ways in order to figure out things about the world. So God is innovative. That's actually one of God's key characteristics. Our Arminian friend that I'm going to be debating, I don't know if he calls himself Arminian, but his the classical theist I'm going to debate, he goes to a verse like God's understanding is infinite and says, see, This is my idea of omniscience, that God knows all propositional truth, past, present, and future in this inherent way, because this verse says that God's understanding is infinite. The word there is not, it's not knowledge. It's not about a propositional knowledge. I know that 2 + 2 = 4. The word there, if you actually do a word search on it, is often used in the context of cleverness, being able to do things, being crafty, so able to work
with
craft.
Crafty and being clever, it relies on other people and responding to them and responding to other situations. You can't be clever just fully on your own, responding to yourself, responding to what you already know 100%. It's this give and go cat and mouse game.
Yeah, notice that they have no use for cleverness in their system. Therefore, when the Bible talks about how clever God is, they have to conflate it with something else. They have to conflate it with their ideas of omniscience, because in their system, God cannot be brilliant. God cannot be clever. God cannot be crafty. There's no use for these skills. And so God doesn't
Which they
have
don't
them.
Even deny, like you were saying, this Anthony guy, he was laughing at the idea that God is brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they're gonna couch it in terms like, well, that's categorically a mistake. Yeah, we understand you categorically think it's a mistake. But here's the problem. The Bible describes God in these terms that you're just laughing at. And so it's you versus the Bible. I don't know who I'm going to go with, the Bible or Anthony.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe it's the Bible.
So I've noticed something about Calvinists, which maybe correct me if I'm wrong. I imagine you'll agree, is that it seems that in any debate on any topic, theology, politics, whatever it is, that there's always, no matter what side you hold, there's always a little bit of mental gymnastics, maybe not gymnastics, but like a complicated truth that you try to explain. I've noticed that when I talk to Calvinists and settled viewers in general, they always constantly have to do these insane, bizarre mental gymnastics to prove their point or to show that they're correct. And it seems to me that the more mental gymnastics you have to go through, the more likely it is that you're incorrect. And so with Calvinists, I see them constantly doing these mental gymnastics about, you know, oh, that's the wrong category, or oh, that's God's permissive will, not his decorative will, and whatnot. Have you noticed that they have to do way more mental gymnastics than almost any issue in any debate ever? I feel like Calvinists are masters at mental gymnastics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's like a fundamental human characteristic, especially when you have set views that contradict facts of reality. That's why I think it's good, and my advice always for these types of debates is say, does the Bible teach XYZ? Mm-hmm. Because then you don't get into these like, oh, the nuance of this must be this, and it could mean this. Well, does the Bible teach your view or not? Does the Bible teach God's timeless? No, there's zero verses. Does the Bible teach exhaustive omniscience? No, all you have to do to win the debate is show me one verse that says that God has exhaustive omniscience. If that doesn't exist, the Bible doesn't actually teach God has exhaustive omniscience.
Which that goes back to the title of your debate, which I love so much. Does the Bible teach that God has exhaustive knowledge of the future?
Because what happens inevitably, if you're talking to a Calvinist in particular, is they'll want to talk about their philosophy so that they can make all these little word plays and to be so nuanced and try to flip things around. So if you just make your discussion about the Bible, they got nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. Either they could prove from the data set that their views are true, or you know, or they can't, and then they have to admit defeat. They want to talk about philosophy because that's what they consider their strong suit. That's where they get their wiggle room. They don't want to talk about the Bible.
Which I love talking about philosophy, but you're right that when it comes down, at the end of the day, what matters isn't our philosophy, it's what does the Bible teach. But I do enjoy getting into the philosophy with them a little bit.
So the problem with the philosophy, well, it is fun to talk about with people about philosophy, but it's really an activity for in-group individuals, not people out of your group, because you don't want someone who's treating your views dishonestly, who's not coming at it from like a correct perspective and making up absurd arguments that you would never make.
Right. And I believe it was you who made a chart. I don't have it in front of me, but a open theism chart. It's a spectrum map of open theism. And closer to the right side, it's more red, and that's more biblical. theologians and the left side is more philosophical theologians. And I remember talking, my dad, Bob Enyart, is on this chart. And I believe that you are all the way on the right side. Christopher Fisher is all the way on the right. And then right to the left of you is my dad, Bob Enyart. And I remember talking to him about this chart. And I remember him, he wasn't upset with the chart, but he was saying it was funny that he thought that you put yourself as more biblical than him. And he wasn't upset with that. But I remember after listening through a lot of your YouTube episodes, I realized I think that you're right in where you put yourself, because I always notice people come up with these arguments. Like my dad, one of his favorite arguments is that time can't be created because time is a prerequisite to creation. And I think that's a good argument, and it's true, but it's very philosophical. Whereas I noticed when I watch through your content, it's all biblical, which there's a time and place for each one, but I do appreciate the focus that you put on biblical arguments and what does the Bible teach.
Yeah, and I do have some podcasts where I talk about my understanding of your dad's material and why he did get rated a little bit more to the left. So he's kind of emotional guy, intuitive guy. And so sometimes he'll say, well, God is love, therefore.
Right.
And it's like, well, that's not like a biblical argument. That's kind of like a philosophical argument. And so,
which the philosophical isn't always incorrect because it's philosophical,
right? But it's not a chart of winners and losers, right? You don't win if you're on the right side and you're on the biblical side, and you don't win if you're on the left side on the philosophical sides. They're just different approaches, and some people use different mixes, and it's just a way to categorize understanding so that people, when they come to open theism and they're trying to interact with open theists, they're not presuming all sorts of absurdities about open theism in general. It kind of gives them a brief overview of different positions, the spectrum of open theistic thought.
Yes. And I do love that chart. I'll have to talk about it on another show at some point. Maybe we'll have you on for that.
There are hard metrics for placing individuals that are not arbitrary.
Awesome. I love it. Getting back a little bit to the attributes, you had mentioned earlier that God is confident and that David is confident. And I noticed one thing about confident people is that confident people tend to delegate power. God, he's the king of kings. He's not the king of robots or the king of, you know, people who he decreed to do exactly what he said to do. He's the king of kings. And those who are insecure are typically unwilling to delegate power. But it seems that throughout the Bible, we see God delegate power constantly, you know, to Moses, to Joshua, to the judges, to the kings. And he's confident that he can fix any issue that man messes up and that he can defeat sin even if man messes up. Now, compare this to the Calvinist, who thinks that God is so weak that if he delegates power and there's any mess up, that he won't be able to fix it. Do you know why? I've asked myself this a lot. Do you know why Calvinists think that if God doesn't know the future exhaustively, that he's completely incompetent? Because it seems that they only have two views of God. One is that he knows the future exhaustively, or two is that he's like a bumbling buffoon who's just, I don't know, foaming at the mouth, unable to accomplish even the most basic of tasks. He's just an idiot. So do you know why it is that they have this weird disconnect?
I think it honestly is a cope. Do you know what like a cope is? It's trying to make sense of your own views, why you hold them and not the others. And so you have to figure out some sort of reason to dismiss open theists. And so you do it through these coping mechanisms, like saying, oh, open theism, you guys can't be assured of your salvation. Like, what are you talking about?
Right,
what
right.
are you talking about? You can't be assured of our salvation. What's our standard for evidence? How are we assured of things? And why does that not fit open theism in general,
right?
How we can be assured of our salvation.
Totally. And I loved earlier you were talking about the loyalty of David. And I've always viewed the loyalty and the faithfulness of God as why we have assurance, is that we have this, you know, long history laid out in the Bible of God being faithful over and over and over, and man messing up over and over and over, yet God is still faithful, even to the point where he goes to the cross and dies for us. And it seems that Calvinists tend to trust God's inabilities, like they trust his inability to sin, his inability to lie, his inability. That's why we can trust God. Where it seems the open theist tends to trust God's ability, his ability to be faithful, his ability to be loyal to us, and his ability to save us. And I've always been frustrated by that from the Calvinists.
Yeah, the problem is that within the Bible, you have all sorts of people. The Bible is a book of advocacy. I don't know if you know this, but Israel, throughout all of history, has had options for other gods other than Yahweh. And so the Bible literally is written and compiled and put together and phrased as advocacy, telling Israel about who the true God is and why they should worship this true God rather than the false gods. And they don't come at it like you would imagine with a classical theism or with closed theism. They don't say, oh, God has all propositional knowledge of all future events, therefore you should have unwavering faith in everything he says. Instead, they do like Isaiah 40 through 48, the trial of the false gods. And what is the argument? The people are set up as judges, and God says, judge between me and these false gods. He says, okay, all these things I've done in the past, you know all these things I've done. Also, I've told you all these things I'm going to do, and then I did them. Therefore, now you have practical evidence to see that, yeah, I'm powerful, I'm capable, and I do what I say I'm going to do. Therefore, please worship me. I'm the correct God here because of this practical evidence. You know who I am. You know my character. You can have faith in who I am by my past actions, by my past deeds. That's how you should have faith in me. It's not closed theistic arguments. It's open theistic arguments. We trust people because of who they are, not inalterable features that they have, not because they're a stone idol who's immutable, nothing like that. In fact, we would trust God better, and we do trust God better, because God changes his mind. He says, Nineveh, I'm going to destroy you in 40 days. They all repent. And what's a good, righteous God to do? The one that we know in the Bible, who has a moral character, a character of justice, a character of righteousness, is he going to still destroy them? No. So they can stay true to his word? No, right. No, he's not going to do that.
He's not a slave to his word.
Right, and that's a defining characteristic. And Jonah said, hey, God, I knew this was like you, that you would have mercy on these people if they would repent. And so I didn't even want to come in the first place, because why? I want these people dead. I want them all dead, but I know you are a God of mercy. You're a God who repents. And that is how God describes his modus operandi, how he acts, his standard operating plans in Jeremiah 18. He says, if there's a good nation, I'm going to bless it. And if it changes and becomes evil, I'm not going to bless it anymore. Right. Things change.
And that's plain as day, but they can't understand that. But it's plain as day. And to me, that seems like that offers so much more hope to humanity. You know, like the vast majority of humanity is evil and they're headed like to hell on jet rockets. And that offers so much hope to know that God can change, and he doesn't have to send them to hell if they're willing to repent and say, I'm sorry, God, I trust you and I turn to you now. God will forgive them and they don't have to go to hell. And that seems so powerful and beautiful, whereas the Calvinists just say, you know, it's set in stone, you know, they're going to hell, there's nothing they can do about it. Too bad, there's no hope.
God can change, and therefore we trust him. We trust his changes and we trust his judgment. We trust him based on who he is, not what he is. We trust him based on character. That's how you trust your wife. Not everyone trusts their wife, but those who do trust their wife because of their wife's character, not because she has a lobotomy, not because
she's unable to commit adultery.
Yeah, a wife doesn't trust her husband just because he's been castrated or something like that. Oh, you now don't have the ability. Now I can finally trust you.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's a weird definition of trust.
That's an unhealthy definition. Unhealthy version of trust.
Yeah, God is a person in the Bible. That is what a lot of people forget. He has a character. He has characteristics. He has a personality. He has a temperament. Oh, here is one thing about his strong passion. King David, one of his psalms, I don't know what psalm it is. I think it's in the 30s. He says, don't punish me in your harsh anger. Jeremiah says the same thing. He says, don't punish me when you're angry. Just wait a bit. Let's cool off. It's because God's not this giant robot in space. his emotions affect the actions that he does.
Wow.
So if he's angry and he's punishing you, that's different than if he's had cooling off time and then punishing you for the same thing.
Wow,
so
that's incredible.
Yeah, God bases his actions off of his emotional states as if the emotions feed into how God responds to humanity.
Right.
Just wow. I asked my kids, would you rather have me punish you when I'm angry or when I'm cooled off and calm and collective? And they all
say
they
when you're calm. Like, right, of course.
They're looking around. The youngest is like, when you're angry. And then all the older kids are like, no, no, that's the wrong one. You don't want him punishing you when he's angry.
It's hard to be angry when your kid says something that cute, though.
They're like, no, we don't want him angry when he's punishing us. That's the wrong. You picked the wrong one.
And it wouldn't be, you know, immoral for God to punish us when he's angry, but he offers us a little bit of mercy even in his punishment, which is pretty cool. I do have a little bit of a rant that I want to go on and get your thoughts. I've played around with this, you know, attack against Calvinists. I want to get your thoughts on it, which I've noticed that Calvinists so desperately want sin to be a good thing. So when something terrible happens, they spend so much time thinking, but what was God's motive in this? What good will this bring? How will this help to glorify God? And they look for a deeper essence of sin, and they want like a better understanding of sin. They desperately want to know, what is the good inside of this? But at the end of the day, it's pretty simple that sin is bad. It's selfishness. There's no deeper truth to uncover, no deeper essence to be discovered. It's sin is evil and it's selfish. That's it. And Calvinism teaches that God brings good out of all sin, and that's why it's allowed to exist. And by the way, that's directly contradictory to Romans 6, where Paul says, you know, should we sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. But I have this question that I've gone through with a lot of Calvinists. And I say, let's imagine a situation where a guy is on a boat and he rapes a girl, and then he kills her, and then he kills himself, and then they both go to hell, and the boat sinks, and it's never found. How does that bring glory to God? How could that ever bring glory to God? And you know what they say? They've all said the exact same thing verbatim. They all say, oh, you know what? I'm not smart enough. I don't know why that brings glory to God, and I'm not God, so I don't know. And in my opinion, that is just simply not an acceptable answer. It's like, feigning humility is not going to cut it this time. If you're going to claim that God is glorified through sin, I believe that you have to explain exactly how that glorifies God, and you have to explain it every time. And if you're going to do these insane mental gymnastics to make God look like a monster who's glorified through these evil, terrible sins like child pornography, you have to do you know, more mental gymnastics to defend him every single time. And pleading ignorance, in my opinion, doesn't cut it. It's frankly not enough. First Peter tells us that we have to be ready with an answer, and we have to be ready with an answer to anyone who asks. And if you're going to defend God's character and your answer is, I don't know why he loves child rape and why that glorifies him, we just know that it does, and we need to have faith that it does, and that we shouldn't challenge him on that, I would like to suggest to you in the audience, if you believe that you're just wrong, your theology is wrong, and not just wrong, but it's immoral, and that you need to change your theology, because that answer is, I think, abysmal. So sorry, there's my little rant. I've been meaning to get that out there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, number one, it's not like a biblical rant, so it's you're not appealing. There are biblical concepts such as God cares what we think about him, and that's pretty evil. And so God doesn't want us thinking that he's evil. And so there should be some sort of answer to this in the Bible if God's controlling all things and it makes him look like this moral monster, which that data doesn't exist. And so Calvinists, they really want to explain the reason why all sin has to have purpose is because all things have to be eternally set, predestined, and chosen by God for God's greatest glory. So if God's not glory is not being maximized, then he created a less than perfect world. This has to be like the best of all possible worlds. Even in Molinism, they claim that out of all available worlds, this one was the most beneficial, gave the most utility, the combination of events was for God's maximal goodness. I do feel your frustration with how evil that makes God, and I feel the moral outrage that you do feel. But it's not like a biblical rant per se. Facts don't care about our feelings often. And so when people say, oh, God's so evil within the Bible because he genocides these people groups, and I guess that might be an argument. I could see a counter argument if you look at what he's doing and why he's doing it and the reasons. And so you could kind of go through that logic. But I do understand where you're coming from. I think a better biblical case could be made if you're pointing to biblical principles about justice, rightness, wrongness, God's character, and especially in the book of Job, where these people were ascribing evil things to God, and the book ends and God's about to kill these people for the things that they were saying about him. They're given the Calvinist criticisms, the Calvinist talking points that God has a purpose for everything. Everything that was happening to Job was due to Job's sin, and these things aren't happenstance. These types of arguments were so abhorrent to God, God was just going to kill all of Job's friends. Job had to intervene for the lives of his friends. So I would caution Calvinists against angering God with the things they say about God.
Wow.
Which is
thank you for holding me to a more biblical standard. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so it's different than just kind of like an emotional rant. You're pointing to the biblical principles that someone should take under consideration. But it is a valid concept that God does care about our feelings and cares about how people perceive him. And so it is a worthwhile question to be asking.
Awesome. We're about out of time here. Where can the listeners go to get some more of your content? I know your YouTube channel, Reality Is Not Optional. Is there anywhere else you would like to point them to?
Yeah, if you were talking about the verse listing that Will Duffy has, I have my own verse listing at godisopen.com. And then you go into the references and you could go to the verse listing. It's a big, huge compiled chart of most proof texts that Calvinists or closed theists will use against open theism. And it's all hyperlinked out. So you could just kind of click and see an open theist response to all these different verses. YouTube's banned the link. So it used to be Facebook has banned it because they hate Christians. And so it used to be the case where you could just give people the hyperlinks if you're in the middle of an argument to one of the verses that they're trying to use as a proof text. You could just send them the hyperlink to that verse directly. But you could do that outside of Facebook. If you're ever in an argument and you need quick links to quick responses, just to signal to someone that open theism does have responses to their talking points.
Gotcha. So we'll link to that. And then your book, God Is Open, is that available just on Amazon, or where can people go to get that?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon on Kindle format in a paperback copy. Or if you want it for free, you could go to academia.edu and search God Is Open. And I have a free PDF version there. I don't want money coming between people and the acquisition of information. And so anything I do, just let me know. I'll try to send you any resources that I do have.
Awesome. Incredible.
So, information should be free.
Amen. So we'll go ahead and link to that also. To remind the audience, Will Duffy and Chris Fisher are doing a debate, the Perfect Tag Team, on October 29th at 7 p.m. Central on the YouTube channel is Practical Faith. And that debate is, does the Bible teach that God knows the future exhaustively? So, Chris, thank you so much for being on the show today. I thought it was great. So for Bob Inyart Live and Real Science Radio, this is Dominic Inyart. May God bless you. Hey, if you enjoyed that show, I want to encourage you. Here at Bob Inyart Live, we've got Keep the Lights On and Pay the Bills. I would encourage you to support us by checking out our resource, God's Biblical Attributes, a sermon series presented by Bob Inyart. You may have been told that the five primary attributes of God are immutability, impassibility, omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience. We refer to these as the Greek and Latin philosophical omnis and ims. They are quantitative. However, the actual five biblical attributes of God are that he is living, personal, relational, good, and loving. These are qualitative. And as Bob teaches in this sermon series, quality trumps quantity. Available now at kgov.com/store. Grabbing your own set of God's biblical attributes will help edify you, spread Bob's teachings, honor his legacy, and keep us on the air.